Welcome to Hemp Barons today, Garrett Graff. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Joy. Always great to be here with you.
I've gotten to do so much really fantastic nonprofit advocacy work with you. I have worked with clients and employers who, of course, use Hoban Law Group and you as their primary counsel for all manner of their business, everything from specifically hemp-related questions, but to IP, corporate advice, employment issues. Hoban Law Group is a full-service firm, a shining firm in all forms of cannabis, not just a national leader, but an international leader. And we've got here with us you, the managing partner of HLG. Again, we're so glad to have you and your expertise here with us today, Garrett.
Right back to you, Joy. Always a pleasure to work with you, and thank you for all the kind words. It's a pleasure.
My honor, and I'm so glad to be able to say them, brother. You are a treasure. Let's start, if we could, with the USDA final rule on hemp, which, of course, went into effect just last month, March 22nd, after receiving 5,900-plus public comments to their interim final rule. Those comments, of course, not just coming from stakeholders across the country at every aspect of the supply chain, but also state and federal legislators, lawmakers, regulators, and even the U.S. Small Business Administration chiming in to say, hey, what happened here? And as you know, and most of us in the industry know, thanks to former USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue's testimony before Congress last year, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, had very much intervened, I'll go so far as to say interfered with the drafting of those rules. And there was just major, major pushback. From your perspective, could you give us a little rundown on what you see as some of the major improvements and changes in the final rule and a couple of the things we still need to work on?
Oh, absolutely, Joy. And you're always one for choice words, interference or intervening or whatnot. But sure, I mean, in terms of the interim final rule versus the final rule, I know that many are somewhat disappointed, and understandably so, in the finished product. I think there's a lot of factors that play into that, everything from the expediency with which the government was trying to move through regulation for the commodity they hadn't dealt with in decades, right or wrong, COVID-related impacts as well. And then ultimately, as you said, some political behind-the-scenes factors amongst multiple different agencies, and then, of course, federal, state, and local. In terms of the final rule itself, some of the things that it addresses, of course, the testing facility, a requirement for the DEA testing facility is obviously one champion point that we can point to in terms of, hey, the government listened to us. They understood some of the issues with respect to mandating the testing facility requirement as being DEA registered. But then, you start looking at some of the other factors within the final rule, and there's certainly some problems. For example, looking at the 0.3% standard, which of course is statutory and USDA could not itself manage or change. The total THC standard, referencing decarboxylation, that is, of course, challenging in and of its own right. Total THC, of course, being where you combine Delta-9 THC as well as then THCA, or 88% of it. And so, it becomes more challenging for farmers. Those are just a handful of some of the things that, were addressed as part of the final rule. At the end of the day, I think a mixed bag is a way to characterize it. We've seen some successes. We've seen some things that still need to be worked on to make the industry more palatable. But at the end of the day, it's what we're faced with, right or wrong right now. We have to find a way to navigate through it.
And about the DEA registered labs, we basically got a reprieve, right? Yeah. They didn't remove the requirement. They said by December 31st, I think, 2022.
Correct.
We're going to put this, and short of a legislative fix that would literally prohibit the requirement, and that is being worked on, that is going to happen. And I think that a lot of folks don't understand that it's fairly untenable even for your final official test. But I think it's important to realize, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Garrett, that would apply to even informal TH testing throughout the growing season, is my understanding, as opposed to just some official test. It would be all tests, including your informal tests, would need to be conducted by a lab that is registered with the DEA.
I think more information will be coming out, as you rightfully point out, right? It's this reprieve, you know, and it provides more time, which is good in the sense that it allows us to figure out more things as opposed to act in a rushed manner and just to implement something. And so I think more information will come out over the course of the next year or so in terms of how this is actually going to work, because both on the government standpoint, on the government side of things, as well as on the industry side of things, there's a lot of pieces that need to be moved and put into play in order to make that work. As you said, it's very untenable as it stands right now. There's a lot of challenges in obtaining and maintaining those registrations and not affecting other streams of revenue and for a testing facility, et cetera. In terms of, you know, formal versus informal tests, certainly for the formal tests, the ones that matter, the ones that declare something to be hemp, that's crucially important. Whether, you know, I don't necessarily want to speculate offhand in terms of down the road, whether informal ones will be, you know, prohibited from other testing facilities or, for example, like internal, sampling and testing, for example. I think that that may be subject to further detail and or advocacy.
Certainly, advocacy and detail. And I think I got that. If the truth be told, of course, I'm an information hoarder, as you are, as anybody in this rapidly developing areas of law are. And so everything that comes in, and thank goodness, I'm also an experienced complex civil litigation senior paralegal. So managing information's our us. But and I think that so every time, whether it was Hoban Law Group, the USDA, anybody else who came up with these are the highlights or this is what changed, I aggregate mm-hmm. all of that, collect all of that. Yeah. And I think I got the piece about the informal testing also, at least as it sits today or at the time that I received the email, that it was for informal testing. But again, you, as usual, right on target with more detail, more advocacy. December 31, 2022 is a little bit away.
But we got 18 months to get to work, Joy. So don't hold your breath. We gotta, you know, try to make some change happen in the meantime. So.
Yep. Well, and you know, all good things right now, all good things. And that also brings me to another aspect I was wondering if you could elaborate on. And that, of course, is the methods for remediating hot hemp or going for a second test, because I know that we certainly got a couple of wins there. And if you would elaborate on those changes.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, some of the things I think we saw positively change in the final rule, things like the testing window moving from 15 days to 30 days. You're talking about potential opportunity for remediation, changing the negligence standard from 0.5 to 1.0. Meaning that, you know, criminal culpability doesn't begin until, I mean, it's markedly different to grow something to be 0.3 versus 1.0. 0.3 to 0.5 is obviously a much closer margin of error, to say the least.
God.
And so certainly I think that that reflects some of the successes that we've had in advocating for our farmers in terms of making sure that they can feel comfortable and confident that they can grow this product and have an opportunity to use it and or remediate it if necessary and not have criminal culpability follow from that. So certainly we saw the governmental agencies, particularly the USDA here, and listen to us in terms of we need more time for testing. We need these remediation opportunities to be more broad and available in order that, you know, entire crops aren't rendered entirely useless. That's just a deterrent effect, a chilling effect to an entire industry if that's the case, as well as then, you know, a lot of farmers who, they're used to growing crops on a farm. They don't want to even think about how they look in orange jumpsuits or whatnot relative to, you know, criminal culpability. So I think those certainly outline some of the positive changes that we saw. And it's certainly my hope that some of those will propel further advocacy with the governmental agencies, but also provide, you know, some confidence for farmers to continue to produce hemp this year and going forward.
Absolutely. And when we talk about the specifically a new method for remediation is in that final rule, which I found very interesting. Remediation can occur by removing a destroying flower material while retaining the stalk, mm-hmm. stems, leaf material, and seeds, or by shredding the entire plant, homogenizing it into a biomass-like material, mm-hmm. then retesting the shredded biomass material for compliance. So that was not allowed previously.
Sure.
And that is allowed now. It doesn't, you know, it's not a gigantic win, but it's something.
It's something. I mean, we did something similar in Colorado a few years ago in the marijuana industry, actually, where, they were simply having to dispose of ground up stock, you know, cannabis stocks that weren't being used in marijuana products, and we were able to, you know, say and prove, hey, we can take these stocks, doesn't present a, you know, public health impact, and instead of just simply disposing of them and literally having to pay to grind them into dirt, we can take them and put them into the industrial hemp supply chain for fibers and other uses. Obviously, you know, the economics of that are far different, and so certainly I'm mindful that you know, having to use either of those remediation methods may not allow or afford for the same sort of economic opportunity that, you know, farmers initially had for that crop. It is at least, you know, some form of opportunity to keep moving.
Well, you created a pathway for innovation, because all of these legal stakes, we talk about the stock like, it's a stock, but you and I both know that stock is the world's most valuable biocellulose, and we're being told to destroy it. So, you know, and I think the innovation from the legal adult use and medical cannabis markets, you know, we're just getting started here, but the issue is people can't innovate if it's unlawful for them to even innovate. So really, Colorado, and thank you as usual for your groundbreaking leadership there. That is tremendous. And all adult use and medical states need to move that forward to begin to at least create a legal pathway for innovation to create value for all of these things. And I think you've heard me say before over the years, brother, I don't believe in byproducts. When it comes to this plant, we have only co-products. So we want to do that. Could you also elaborate, and then we'll move on to another subject here, but in terms of performance-based sampling, could you explain to our listeners on the USDA final rule what performance-based sampling is, which is now permitted and definitely a win?
Yeah, so that was certainly one of the primary comments, a lot of those 5,000 plus comments that you referenced before that they had, is, you know, the sampling and testing protocols outlined were very, very stringent in terms of, and restrictive, onerously, so how operators could, in fact, you know, take samples and test them and prove compliance. And so in terms of performance-based sampling, the USDA effectively provided an opportunity or a pathway for specific states or regions to, you know, be more nimble in terms of how they evaluate and or allow for samples to be taken and tests to be taken. You know, relative to regional, you know, based factors, or, you know, factors that are closer to the quote unquote ground, so to speak, no pun intended. But, you know, factors that the USDA at the federal level cannot consistently apply itself across the board. And so in terms of affording for performance-based sampling, it will provide greater flexibility to state departments of agriculture and in turn the farmers of those states to have input, to have a voice, terms of what sampling does and does not work in those regions for a variety of operational reasons, to ensure that, you know, it all makes sense, that there's incentive for farmers to grow, that they can meet the requirements, and that state departments of agriculture can, you know, maintain that program.
And to elaborate, you know, we have states that are now coming up with lists of prohibited varieties or varieties of concern, and yet they also are aware of varieties that are already becoming tried and true or have been. And to give an example for the listeners of performance-based sampling, what we mean here in the United States, in our 50 little countries that comprise, you know, the mainland here, and Alaska and Hawaii. In Canada, they've got provinces, but basically federal law that has been governing and regulating the hemp industry since 1998. And in the last few years or so, although things are going by so fast, it's probably in the last 4 years now, after multiple years of regulation, the Health Canada, which still regulates the crop, it's not some Ministry of Agriculture, it's Health Canada's Office of Controlled Substances that is really monitoring this crop and regulating this crop. But they, in that country, but they allow for a waiver where if a variety has tested below 0.2% THC, bearing in mind, Delta 9, bearing in mind that clearly the definition in Canada is 0.3, but this is the bar for the criteria for it to be on a special list. If that variety has tested at 0.2 or below D9 THC for 3 years, it no longer requires that testing and sampling. It is now sort of free to be planted and move around the country. And that's what we're talking about with performance-based sampling here. It sounds to me like the USDA is saying to states, use your best judgment on creating a system of where your limited resources should be best spent sampling fields to make sure that they are compliant within the amount of THC that is allowed for a hemp plant.
Certainly. I think that's well said, Joy. I mean, certainly seed certification is a part of that in terms of creating confidence. I think the confidence level established by the final rule is 95%. It is that confidence they're looking for. That's kind of what's being referenced by Health Canada standards is 3 years. Similarly, some states in the U.S. have created seed certification programs or processes. Admittedly, it's been challenging to figure out all the factors, climate factors, varietal factors, regional factors, et cetera. And so it's been a slow moving process in terms of, what seeds can or cannot be certified and provide, that sort of integrity of data necessary. And as you've suggested, it's also led to, some varietals being discouraged, if not prohibited. Just given the proclivity for exceeding 0.3%, which, again, can be a very touchy standard.
Very much so. Very much so. So I think that is a pretty good win that we got there for the states, especially considering resources and especially considering that the USDA is still mandating sampling agents now, which they define. And the reality is, Health Canada has never once said, oh, we're taking this on. They don't have a ton of resources. It's a very large country spread out in population. So they actually created more jobs and said, here, licensed agrologists, and I know here we call them agronomists, but in Canada, for some reason, they're agrologists, but licensed agrologists can apply to become THC field samplers and then have an additional stream of revenue for themselves because Health Canada isn't doing it. The licensed THC field samplers are doing it, but interesting stuff in any event. Let's move on to another subject, which of course, is creating a bit of a groundswell now and a momentum. And I certainly understand the urge for folks to say, hey, let's change the definition of hemp to 1% THC. And when we're talking about THC right now, we're talking about Delta 9. Because it's a no-brainer. It will increase biodiversity, and that is certainly true. Nobody could argue with that. It will increase biodiversity. It will, give our farmers a break so they can continue to grow extract hemp, .. and I suppose continue to lose their shirts growing extract hemp, because we're realizing, of course, and have known for some time, that it takes only a little bit of hemp to make a whole lot of hemp extract and distillate. We want our farmers, who are the real heroes here, who we have nothing without them, without getting those seeds in the ground for these trillion-dollar industries, which are fiber and grain. And as we build that infrastructure, they will come online. Without them, we have nothing, and we need for them to have successful experiences, and we need to support them every step of the way to do that. And so folks say, hey, let's increase to 1%, increase biodiversity, give the farmers a break, we'll have more options. And the reality is that there are lots of really important factors to consider as we, as a nation, choose whether or not we're going to move forward with the 1% increase or not, particularly bearing in mind that while the definition of hemp under which we live today, and this is a wonderful, incredible definition, it still hadn't had the scientific sophistication to deal with our reality. It named a plant. It was within the Farm Bill. It basically defined a plant. The definition itself lives within the Agricultural Marketing Act of 1946, not the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act or anything like that. It created a plant with 0.3% THC, which is 3,000 parts per million, bearing in mind that 1% is 10,000 parts per million. So I think in many ways that we didn't have all the science, but we got this great definition. I think things are going to change as the science comes out and everything starts to settle down. And we certainly don't want to see we're not going backwards with prohibitions. We just need to dial in the science. So talk to us a little bit about what you see as concerns and important things to consider while we have the discussion on should we increase this definition.
Yeah, it's a really challenging issue in a certain respect, Joy. I mean, certainly you point out absolutely there are challenges presented day in, day out to our farmers in terms of how they can grow hemp without being challenged with having to forcibly lose their crop and or face criminal culpability. Thankfully, we've at least in part solved the criminal culpability issue for now by raising that negligence standard. But still, it leaves the challenge of if you grow above 0.3% outside the margin of error, then you're forced into the remediation protocols, which still, again, devalues your crop. And as you said, there's already economic challenges, in terms of the production of hemp. In terms of, the groundswell support, I certainly think that there's growing support for, changing the definition in some form or fashion. I also think it's more complicated than people may give credit to. First of all, you pointed out, some of these components of the definitional issues, as it stands today. We have a 0.3% standard that applies to both the grown and produced crop, as well as to finished goods and, some of the extracts and whatnot being derived therefrom. Certainly, we want both of those to be lawful, but to your point, is the same numerical standard appropriate for both of those things? That may be something that needs to be addressed, especially with some of the product types hitting the market right now that are below 0.3% THC, but present some product liability concerns in the marketplace. From a more political standpoint, I think it's important to understand Delta 9 versus total THC. Of course, many people don't like total THC, given that it's a more expansive standard. I also think, though, however, it will be more challenging to amend the definition to 1.0% Delta 9, which in effect means close to 2.0% total THC, which, that's not a factor lost on a lot of advocacy groups and frankly, the marijuana lobby, and so to a certain extent, we have to understand that, we have this cousin of the plant, right? A separate variety of the same genus that has been our friend slash cousin for years upon years now. And yet this effort potentially flies right in the face of that friendship or that familial relationship in the sense that it misaligns the interests. And so I think that there's going to have to be a lot of thought given to how we can approach that. It also, presses on the idea of whole plant regulation, right? As opposed to, trying to change how hemp is regulated and how marijuana is legalized or not and how it's regulated. It then calls into question, well, shouldn't we just regulate by intended use that helps resolve some of these problems? That's a much bigger picture solution, but it's also a much bigger problem and many more complications to solve legislatively in DC right now. So that what that means is it takes more time to get there. In the short term, I think trying to find or identify incremental changes that we can provide shorter term relief to our farmers and to the hemp industry is important. Certainly, there remain these practical challenges of the 0.3%. We also have to then be mindful of what will that take? That's a statutory fix, not a regulatory one. USDA can't do that on their own. It requires Congress to act perhaps a presidential executive order and then corresponding changes at each of the state levels too. So all that said, that's just, I think, three things offhand in terms of some of the challenges or factors needing to be considered. I certainly think that a change is welcome and due, I think, you know, certainly anything we can do to support our farmers and in the industry is helpful, but we also have to be careful for what we wish for, because depending on what the proposed changes are, that may carry with it much, greater consequences is the wrong word, but complications in terms of how that interrelates with marijuana over the course of the next 3, 5, 10 years of regulation.
So I think what I want to do is just sort of drill into some of these issues to really help to expand the collective knowledge base of the listeners and the audience and sure. The growing hemp Absolutely. Industry, right? And a lot of folks, so the quick background on how did we come up with 0.3? Now, many folks, they'll say, oh, it was some arbitrary number, but they don't really understand. Now, that was Dr. Ernest Small from Canada, who is now the principal research scientist for Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. He was put into this position of having to come up with something. 0.3 is, without going into a ton of science here, because I want to keep this focused on law and regulation, that is a number that he came up with along with Arthur Cronquist, who was his co-researcher, that was published in 1976, actually, in the Netherlands-based scientific journal Taxon, a practical and natural taxonomy for cannabis.
That 10 times fast.
Yeah, really. So now, however, of course, Ernest Small often says and has been quoted as saying in 2018, when the 2018 Farm Bill passed, he was interviewed and said, hey, 0.3% is very conservative. And my skepticism today, bearing in mind, this was now from 1976 to 2018, he's making this quote, my skepticism today is if we were to adopt a criterion for non-abusive use of the plant, such as for oilseed, an important product, I'd suggest 1% as a more reasonable criterion. He also says that, however, 1% is more reasonable because that is the point at which they see intoxication. So to your point, intoxication. And what I want to give by way of I wish we could do it visually, but we're going to do it audibly here, a comparison for the listeners to understand that, again, 0.3% is 3,000 parts per million, but 0.3% of a total product could end up being, 0.3% of a total product results in a Delta 9 THC, should you want to take it there, that can absolutely cause intoxication. We have seen already legal hemp extract products, they're in huge volume, thus the ability to increase the milligrams of THC, but that have 10 milligrams of Delta 9 THC in them. Now, for a gal like me, it's going to take a whole lot of that to have an effect on me. But for the average person, particularly someone who has never consumed cannabis or THC before, 10 milligrams of THC may very well have a tremendous effect on them. Sometimes 5 or 2 milligrams could on a certain person. So, which is putting states in the position of sophisticated states of saying, gee, I wonder if we're going to need to put a cap, as New York has, on the amount of milligrams of Delta 9 THC that can be in a product, because under this definition, there can be a whole lot. And my way of comparing is to let folks know that in the European Union, by and large, in a finished product, 3 parts per million of THC is what is allowed in a finished hemp product. In Germany, 5 ppm is what's allowed in hemp seed oil. Australia and New Zealand, 5 to 10 parts per million for whole, hulled, and processed seed cake. 10 is for the hemp seed oil. In Canada, it's 10 ppm for hemp seed food ingredients. And for Switzerland, it's 10 to 20 ppm parts per million for whole and hulled. Here, we're looking at this 0.3% weird definition that didn't take into account finished products, but rather took into account the definition of the plant. So we're dealing with that. And further comparison, in terms of the total Delta 9 THC daily intake determination, and right now, as you most likely well know, Garrett, IA, the European Industrial Hemp Association, which does a lot of the heavy lifting for the whole planet, is embarking on a study to create research and science on what a ppm of Delta 9 THC would actually on an average human being, et cetera, cause intoxication. But in the EU right now, they're saying basically 90 ppm per day. In Croatia, 540 ppm per day on this is a daily intake of THC. Switzerland, Australia, and New Zealand are saying 630 ppm per day. And Canada is saying 1,260 ppm. Again, this is not the definition of what goes into a finished product. This is a separate statistic of what these different countries have determined as a safe total D9 THC daily intake determination. And here we are in America again with this 3,000. Well, if we go to 1%, it's 10,000 parts per million. So surely we would not want this increase to affect finished products. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, the question I was going to ask you, Joy, is this intended or proposed change for 1.0% to help our farmers or for finished product, right? And I think in all likelihood, we probably can't have both. It's very easy if we disconnect the two, and that may be a short-term pathway, is by disconnecting the two, you can say for purposes of production only, production meaning, cultivation by farmers, we grow up to, 1.0%. Delta 9 versus total THC, I still anticipate there's going to be some, argument over, which of those standards apply. But regardless, I think that we would welcome either of those changes, right? In the sense that it would greatly expand for our farmers. But to your point, in terms of for finished products, I actually anticipate we may well see the regulation going downward to the point and the examples that, you referenced. New York has put in place potency caps. I think more states are starting to, look at potency caps as well as also than just labeling, the potency to make it well known. But from the perspective of the number I hear is 2 milligrams, right? Especially for someone that's a new user, that's kind of the threshold of what will start to produce a psychoactive effect. When hemp was legalized under the 2014 Farm Bill and then reaffirmed in the 2018 Farm Bill, the premise was that hemp is this benign, non-psychoactive, non-intoxicating commodity that will save our planet. And that's a very righteous and understandable and good narrative. But to now be, to a certain extent, misusing that narrative the result of that narrative to put out products that compete with marijuana products in the marketplace in state-regulated dispensaries, it's a problematic optical situation for a lot of folks within the hemp industry. I was actually just speaking with someone recently. They wanted to put a 15 milligram per serving Delta 9 THC product to market. And here in Colorado, in the marijuana marketplace, the mandatory or the maximum THC potency cap is 10 per milligrams per serving. So you're effectively
most states.
Yeah, so you're putting out a per serving product that is more potent by 50% than the maximum allowed under the marijuana regulations. And so I think there's a day of reckoning is too strong of a word. I think there's going to be some harsh truths and realities that on the product manufacturing side, the hemp industry is going to have to face in terms of, we can advocate for this increase in potency, at the farm level, but that will ultimately lend itself well to this one plant regulation model, right? The more cannabinoids you can grow, because to your point, Joy, on the hemp side, what's the point of increasing to 1.0% for our farmers if we literally need 10% of the acreage necessary? To be honest, there legitimately is no point to increasing the threshold at that point because we don't need that acreage. And to a certain extent, you can make the argument that you're saving the farmers in that way, saving them from losing their own shirts. But from a standpoint of, thinking towards one plant regulation, it makes sense in the sense of, okay, farmers, you're not the ones who are, extracting the cannabinoids. We want you to become as efficient at scale of producing cannabis, not marijuana, not hemp, but cannabis. There, you know, thereafter, it would then be regulated separately based upon intended use. In the short term, sure, I don't have an issue with, increasing the, THC threshold. I think that's going to be an easier advocacy push for all the various lobbyists and stakeholders at play in Washington, D.C. But I think that has to be separated from, cannabinoids and extracts and finished goods, not to suggest that those should not be lawful, but that the for all the science you've mentioned, Joy, none of that science makes sense as to finished products, as New York has provided us an example for. And so I think you're going to almost see divergence between farm and product with respect to the definition of hemp over the coming months and year or two.
No doubt about it. And so much for me, just to piggyback on there, number one, we are seeing, and two is a good number, we're seeing a lot of science. And I think we're going to probably find, although, I don't have an oracle, Aya will do their work, but 2.5 is really looks like what I'm seeing a lot of that number for in terms of intoxication. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. The responsible stewardship of this crop, it's why we just saw the U.S. Hemp Roundtable last month put forth a press release saying, you know, we do not condone for our members or for the industry in general to be marketing products in the name of hemp that are intoxicating or causing a euphoric effect, or marketed as causing a euphoric effect, or marketed for their intoxicating purposes. And the U.S. Hemp Authority recently came out and said that they will not certify Delta 8 products. Now, of course, we love all of our tetrahydrocannabinols and we love all of our cannabinoids. But Delta 8, of course, by and large, in the hemp plant is not produced in commercially viable amounts. We're looking at synthetic converted cannabinoids, and there's all manner of, there are more clean and passive techniques, and then there are more toxic techniques. And so it's an issue. And what we really want is to responsibly steward this plant. We are not here, and I say we, I'm always speaking like I'm a plant, but it's 30 years. Give me a break. Sometimes I think I'm a plant. We aren't here for intoxication. For the love of God, folks, please avail yourselves of the legal adult use and medical cannabis markets. If you're looking for that type of an effect, or you need that for your medical condition, but not hemp. And they're under a lot more regulations, the legal adult use in medical markets, and for us to be encroaching on it, it is not very diplomatic or gracious. I also, though, to drill into a couple of more points on this 1%, another very practical reality, and let me know if some of your clients, of course, without naming names, if you've been hearing this from them, and there is also a ground swell of processors saying, listen, guys, even when we get biomass that is at the maximum current threshold of 0.3% Delta 9, it's laborious in terms of just labor, materials, the process to remediate the hemp so that we can bring it down, the finished product, to an allowable amount. And if they're saying, and if you come to me with 1% biomass, I'm probably going to reject it. We're hearing this a lot, because you're just going to complicate and make that process more burdensome. What do you have to say about that? Are you hearing these things from any of your clients?
So far, I hear some of that, but I think part of it is also, to a certain extent, waiting to see there being critical mass in DC, right? Like, there's a lot of this talk internal to the hemp industry, but on the whole, I still think, there's still some work to be done in terms of the critical mass to actually make that move upwards. I mean, certainly on the processor side, if anything, I actually see more commentary around work in progress hemp extract, intermediate hemp extract, the ensuring that DEA or anyone else isn't going to come after them when they have those concentrated materials during, the stages of processing. So, certainly I think that there's plenty of consideration being given from processors at that level, but from the standpoint of if you give the processors the regulatory leeway to, do their job, even if the THC threshold is increased, I think you would see folks get on board with that. But right now it's, you can take 0.3% hemp, you process it, that intermediate crude is 1-2, depending on what it is, right? It's going to be multiple times the 0.3% amount. Obviously, that would be concentrated or further diluted or reworked or whatever before it's into a finished good. But that's one of the largest concerns I typically see amongst the processors right now. But to your point, I mean, everyone in this industry is running on margins right now. And so I'm certainly appreciative and sensitive to the fact that, you know, they're trying to make sure that they're not underwater just simply by what biomass they choose to process.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to the fact that, you know, oftentimes, again, we're going to get more sophisticated here as the chips fall and science unfolds and the FDA hopefully creates a regulatory framework or is otherwise directed by Congress via H.R. 841 to create that regulatory framework. You know, I think the bottom line is that the FDA does not consider synthetic botanical constituents to be legally marketed as dietary ingredients or simply to be dietary ingredients. So what we see with this remediated THC is a lot of conversion. And if that starts to become not allowed and we've got this 1% that we're starting with and all this remediated THC, I think we may see some issues there. Now, on an international trade perspective, when I speak with our international partners, as you well know, at Hoban Law Group, there's sort of an international federation that is being formed. We're all so busy dealing with our own countries, but certainly we speak Europe, the European Industrial Hemp Association, China, New Zealand, Canada, the Canadian Hemp Trade Alliance, all of that, and the United States. And folks would like to see these national leaders is we are discussing, of course, more of a concerted global effort to increase where we're all kind of signing on to one another's efforts. If that's what, if we want to increase, if the global industry consensus is we need to increase, then perhaps it could be a concerted global effort as opposed to one country and then another country. Because I think another thing that folks maybe not seeing around the corner, that if we're at 1%, understand that in all these other developed countries that are still at 0.2 and 0.3, they will consider our products and derivatives from that plant to not be a hemp plant anymore. They will consider it to be derived from marijuana and not eligible for international trade. So some unintended consequences here. Anything you wanted to add on that?
I entirely agree with you. I mean, the EU finally just got from 0.2 to 0.3%. Now we're asking them to, instead of going up 0.1%, to go up 0.7%. You know, we got some work to do there in terms of advocacy and getting consensus, but I entirely agree with you. Right now, you know, it's a patchwork. Thankfully, you know, regulation and or, you know, enforcement of regulation across the world in many countries is, you know, evolving in a positive way, in the sense that, you know, hemp companies are still, you know, able in many cases to freely ship products as regulators start to understand more and more about, you know, what's going on. But as that regulation evolves, I think we're going to have to be sensitive to this idea of consistency across the board. To your point about synthesis, I mean, it's not just remediation of THC. You know, what cannabinoid are folks synthesizing Delta 8 from?
CBD.
And so the point there is that if synthesis is a problem, if conversion is a problem, then it's a problem for just about every cannabinoid in the plant. Both psychoactive and non-psychoactive. And so that's something that, you know, we as an industry have to be mindful of and steward well and very carefully, because there are things like the Controlled Substances Analog Act, immediate precursors, cannabimetic agents. That's always a mouthful, right? You know, all these issues that, you know, thankfully there's effectively been discretion to date, but we don't want to kind of compel implication of those analyses just based upon, you know, the nimbleness of, you know, how operators are in fact operating. So we have to be thoughtful as to how we're going to operate within the industry, how we're going to steward the industry, and then ultimately how that would be reflected in sensible regulation across the board to make sure that operators can do what they need to do and are not stymied, but that regulators can have confidence in that what's being produced is appropriate for, you know, going out to the marketplace.
Absolutely. And then when we think about economic stability for the farmer, clearly this and the cannabinoid industry isn't going anywhere, because folks, we have discovered in our lifetimes that we've got these things called endocannabinoid systems. They regulate homeostasis. It's the master controller of our bodies. It's like discovering that the world is round and not flat in our lifetime. So the market is only growing, and it will continue to grow as science and products and quality assurance and all of those things come to bear out. But the issue is that we're at, and it's already changing a bit, we've been at this sort of low volume, high margin industry when we talk about CBD and hemp extract, and it is already taking the turn and will eventually move to high volume, low margin. So when we talk about this increase for 1%, how much economic stability is that going to give in a U.S. farmer when we know that as the infrastructure to process the longest, strongest stock in the world for fiber, and as the infrastructure grows to process that nutrient-dense and incredible seed, the largest, the highest digestible form of protein in the entire planet animal kingdom, the perfect ratio of omega-3s and 6 and all the many other things we can do with that seed, as that infrastructure grows, those are the trillion-dollar markets that feed paper, textiles, human and animal nutrition, body care, building materials, biocomposites, and plastic. Supercapacitors, energy, fuel, wood pellets, charcoal, nanotechnology, biomedical applications. Stop me, brother. I'll just keep going. That's where the economic stability is for the farmer, not in extract hemp. And so I really just want us to just be well-informed as we move forward with these decisions during as this movement takes place and as this exciting movement and an exciting expansion of the hemp industries takes place as the crop reemerges here. But indeed, I tell people, if they tell me I've never planted hemp before and I'm going to grow for extract in 2021, I literally respond to them, do not pass go, do not collect $200. And unless it's a variety trial for some fun reason, do not grow extract hemp.
I mean, that's the right answer. And you're right in terms of where the stability comes from, in terms of how that correlates to 1.0%, obviously those varieties are going to produce, less or fewer of the extracts. So it's going to give you much longer, runway in terms of producing, large industrial type plants or hybrid type varieties where you're going to see a mix of both, right? But at the end of the day, there is somewhat of a contrast between, what's currently being bred right now as plant extract, hemp, which are, far more marijuana-like in their composition versus, industrial type varieties or even hybrid type varieties. And so I think that there certainly could be, plenty of growth opportunity there if, you're also not at anywhere near at risk of hitting that 0.3% threshold in the same time frame that you would be growing a, extract-based variety.
Such important stuff for us to be thinking about. And I can't, when you and I get together, it's almost like there's no time at all because I'm such a nerd. These are my favorite things to talk about. And yet how quickly our time has come to a close here. Clearly need to have you back on, and I will.
I'll look forward to it.
Is there, okay, me too, brother. Is there a question I didn't ask or something that you want to make sure you leave the listeners with that I may not have given you an opportunity to?
I think it's kind of, in summation, what are the things to look forward to, right? We can talk about all these challenges over the past 18 months, between COVID, commoditization of the CBD pricing, all of these difficult, emotional, challenging issues that the industry has faced. What should we look forward to in a positive light? And so from that perspective, I think the growth opportunity on the industrial side of the plant certainly provides, much to hope for and work towards. You see companies like Patagonia and whatnot, of course, doing their part in trying to create some infrastructure, but of course, that's not necessarily going to serve an entire industry or infrastructure for that side of the that side of the hemp industry. And so certainly the collective efforts that can be made to help, make the volume and the capacity a reality for purposes of processing and ultimately commercializing industrial hemp, the industrial versions of hemp, I think is super important. On the product side of things, despite the relative lack of need for acreage, that aside, I still think that there's plenty of opportunity and product portfolio expansion on the extract side for manufacturers or brands, right? You look at products that are with high potencies of CBD these days, but CBD may well be normalized in the many multivitamins or supplements that you see on shelves down the road. What do we need to help push that forward is FDA guidance. And so we've seen kind of some backwards movement from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, not because of hemp or CBD, but just because of a presidential transition. And so it's our hope that later this year or going into next year that we'll see some additional guidance from FDA that will provide confidence and provide that opportunity. And so again, albeit limited in acreage, at least it still provides economic opportunity, jobs for processors, for product manufacturers, for brands, and things of that nature. The going may not be quite as good as it was 3 years ago, but that's natural for any emerging marketplace. And so now it's time to roll up your sleeves and get to work on how to edge out everyone else and make your brand or your company what it is on your own.
That is one heck of an awesome summary, Garrett. Man, if you folks out there are looking for literally the world-class national and international leaders in hemp law and legal representation, please go to PodConnects, PodConnex, for this episode.com so that you can figure out how to find Garrett and the many experts that he manages as managing partner. She said with a giggle because she knows how much work it is to be the managing partner. Garrett, thank you so much for being on. Thank you for everything that you do.
Same right back to you, Joy. Always a pleasure. I look forward to the next time.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hi, my name is Kira Reed, and I'd like to invite you to be inspired by the women who are leading in the cannabis industry. Each week, we will discuss empowerment, leadership, and what it means to be a woman in charge in marijuana, hemp, and CBD. As the founder of the Women Empowered in Cannabis community, I have had the great pleasure to get to know many brilliant and talented women who are CEOs, executives, politicians, advocates, and community leaders that are focused on creating a cannabis economy that is just, fair, and equal. We'll learn how these women make decisions, how they navigate a predominantly male industry, and what they're doing to level the playing field for women. I hope you'll join us.